This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The character Samson in the Bible is kind of a lughead. He's a doofus and a brute. For those not familiar with the story in the Old Testament or the old Hollywood movie, the religion scholar Karen Armstrong goes through it in her new book about Scripture. Samson, she explains, was miraculously conceived to save the Israelites from the Philistines. He's huge, has incredible strength, and he makes this vow to God that he will not drink wine during his life or ever cut his hair. But he's tempted by beautiful Philistine women, and he gets cocky, and they trick him, and they cut his hair, and they blind him. You can read about it in the book of Judges, but before things go bad for Samson, Armstrong says there's another part of the story that interests her.
One day, he's on his way to get married to a Philistine woman, and a lion attacks him. And Samson is so strong, of course, that he just picks it up and just breaks it to pieces and throws it in a bush. And then a year later, he's in the vicinity again. And he thought, well, I'll just go and see what's happened to that lion, the body. And he gazes at it and finds that in the skeleton of the lion, a swarm of bees have nested and made it their hive. And the skeleton is oozing with honey and oozing with life as the bees crawling over and creating their honey. He just thrusts his hands into this mass and goes running like a child back to mum and dad to show them this honey, and together they eat the honey. The point is, he realizes he's an artist in some way. He's looking at that honey with the eye of an artist. Instead of just seeing a rather disgusting and disturbing sight of a decaying lion, he sees the union of sweetness and death, two disparate things, the way violence and death and yet deliciousness and sweetness are all conjoined. And somehow he had brought this into being. From that moment on, nearly everything he says has a double resonance, like a poet. If you remember the famous riddle that he provokes, out of strength comes sweetness. So that's a sort of a wonderful image, a paradoxical image of what he saw there, deeply in that decaying lion and the honey and the swarms and the sweetness. This thug has become an artist.
And this makes an important point for Karen Armstrong about Scripture. Listen to how beautiful and strange that story is. But she says people today miss it, the devout and the skeptics, because they think Scripture is supposed to be taken literally. Well, it's not, she says. In her book, Armstrong argues it was never intended to give clear answers or even doctrine. Scripture was art, and it always insisted to those who encountered it that they move forward and just offer love. She also sees the Samson story as a way of reading Scripture.
We have, when we're reading Scripture, a fusion of both the nasty and the sweetness and the beauty and wonder of this extraordinary sight. But we mustn't keep it to ourselves. We have to plunge our hands into there at the risk of being stung, being called names by people, by being mocked at for seeing something in these strange stories, and sharing it, taking it immediately to others. And this seemed to me a way to end that story, an art form that fuses opposites, but which has a relevance that we share with others to make the world a better, sweeter place.
Karen Armstrong's book is called The Lost Art of Scripture, Rescuing the Sacred Texts. I guess where I wanted to begin, I was interested in that figurine you mentioned in the Ulm Museum.
Because Lion Man.
Lion Man, exactly. Evidence that human beings, gosh, 40,000 years ago, I guess it was, were able to think of something that doesn't exist. Why begin there with this work of art?
Well, because, first of all, religion has always expressed itself in terms of art, not in terms of rational or scientific discourse. You think of the Lascaux Caves, all those exceptional pictures of the local animals of the region who are seen as divine, and we know that those caves were a cult form, but long before the Lascaux Caves, 40,000 years ago, in southern Germany, kept in a special cave, a figurine was found, 31 centimetres high. And it's probably the very first expression of religion in the human race. And why so? Because it presents something that doesn't exist. Lion Man has the head of a cave lion, but he has a partly human body. And so in this figurine, these people were imagining a lion man, two inimical species blended together, and felt that confluence as divine. And why does he not exist? Human beings use their imagination. When I was a child, I had to learn a definition of God in the Roman Catholic Catechism. God is the supreme spirit who alone exists of himself and is infinite in all perfections. Now, that was a pretty deadening little definition for me at the age of 8. But I now think it's incorrect. First of all, because it draws breath and simply defines. The word define means to set limits upon a reality that must go beyond all we can think and know. And as we've said, he does not exist of himself. He is not a spirit. He is spirit. God is in all that is. And in that conjoining of Lion Man, a being that did not exist, that ability to overcome their terror, but admire the beauty and grace of the cave lion, human beings were transcending themselves, going beyond themselves, and also thinking of their own transformation, as though they too could get some of his attributes by embracing him in this way.
This also gets us to a point you come back to from time to time in the book, and that's the interplay between the right and left hemispheres of the brain. And I wanted you to say something about this. The right hemisphere of the brain, you mention, this is what we're learning about in the brain, is it's essentially where there is the creation of music and poetry and religion. It connects us, as you say in the book, to the outside world. But then there's the left side, which is the inside world. Talk about this interplay.
Well, it seems neurologists have become very interested in the right hemisphere recently. It used to be called the minor hemisphere because of our preference in the modern West for analytical and rational thought. But it seems that information from the outside world reaches us first in the right hemisphere. And we get a glimpse of reality, which is like Lion Man, a confluence of everything, where things are joined together, where things blend into one another. And it's also, therefore, the home of our empathy and sense of justice, because we sense the connection between ourselves and other people and other beings, and see the world linked. It's the world of metaphor. When you say, my love is a red, red rose. But then we can't stay in this lovely meditative state. The information then passes almost immediately to the left hemisphere, where we analyze it, find out what use it can be to us, give it a definition, and then it's supposed to move back to the right, where so we get a glimpse of both. So all art is rooted in the right hemisphere, and our sciences and technology all have their home in the left. And that's why we've made why religion seems so difficult to us, because that catechism answer is a, very much a left brain creation.
Right. Well, one of the themes of the book is how all of this focus on the empirical, on science and the rational, which of course you underline is important and good and all of those things, but it's led us, you say, led us to cultivate only half of our mental capacities fully.
Well, I think this is even since I was growing up, there's more and more emphasis, say, in education on pushing children to work on the sciences and not studying things so much like literature, poetry, history, indeed. And that's made religion very difficult for us. Because we think that God is a being, and we've tried to prove that he exists. And just as we would prove a theorem. And because he lies outside the rational, people say that therefore it's not true. But art is true. It's true in another way. And it gives us insight into a harmonious world in which you have Brahman, the all. Wordsworth said that, "I have learned to look on nature not as he did as a young man, but he's exercised his brain in a different way. And he no longer sees nature as separate from humanity. He sees in it, he sees in nature the still, sad music of humanity. The two are conjoined, linked together, nor harsh, nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me in the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man. A motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things." So he's saying God is not a being stuck up there in the heavens, but he rolls through all things. He's present in the mind of man, in the natural world. It's what the Indian Aryans called Brahman, the all, or what the Chinese called heaven, a reality which runs through just not just the spiritual world, but is linked up organically with both earth, the natural world, and humanity. And together they form a partnership. It's very different from our idea of God stuck in the heavens.
You say in the book that we seem to be losing the art of scripture in the modern world, not using it. You say we don't seem to be using it to transform our lives, more to confirm our own views, and that we've come to read sacred texts in what you call in the book a doggedly literal manner. Talk a little bit about, I'm interested in the subtext of the book, rescuing the sacred text. You're trying to get us back to that original idea of what scripture may have been.
Yes, because I was brought up thinking that scripture tells you what you must believe. But in fact, none of the scriptures do that. In fact, they make a point of showing that when we talk about God or the sacred, we don't know what we're talking about. Now, if you look, for example, at the book of Genesis, which is a scripture that many people will be familiar with here in the West, and it starts up with a God who seems very familiar to us, everything a God should be. He's totally powerful. He brings everything into existence in a mere sort of just by speaking. And he's a good God. He's benign. He blesses everything he has made and says it is all good. Even his own old enemy, Leviathan, whom he fought to in other myths about the world to bring the world into being. And he's totally fair and impartial. He blesses all that he has made. But the rest of the book of Genesis completely and almost systematically undercuts that image of God. The nice, benign God becomes a sort of cruel destroyer, not a creator, at the time of the flood, wiping out nearly the whole of the human race in what can only be described as a fit of pique. And then finally, at the end of the book of the Genesis, the God who was supremely in control of his creation, he'd already lost control of the creation by chapter 3, but he disappears altogether. And Joseph and his brothers have to work things out for themselves with no divine intervention, relying on their own dreams and insights, just as we do. And this, of course, is the world we know, where life is not fair. And a God who seems to have disappeared. And constantly the scriptures do this. I think it's interesting that the Jewish people didn't take the first chapter of Genesis as their favorite image of God. They chose the terrifying vision that Ezekiel had in the 6th century when he'd just been deported to Babylonia and was suffering from the trauma of exile and this uprooting. And you cannot make head nor tail of what this God he's seeing is like. He says it's like this, but it's not like this. And it's terrifying. It fills him, he says, with rage and bitterness. But it also, he says, it's like it's as sweet as honey. So you have this conjunction of opposites and something that is impossible to define. And all the scriptures do that. And I think it's significant that that catechism definition that I quoted earlier, that all those catechisms in both the Catholic world and the Protestant world were put together after the Reformation. Because at first, the reformers, people like Luther and Calvin, thought that if you just gave a poor man a copy of the Bible and he was able to read it, that's you didn't need theologians or poets or bishops to tell him what to do. It will be completely clear for just by reading the Bible. But then the reformers found that they couldn't agree among themselves about fundamental issues, that scripture seemed contradictory. And so they said that only, from having said that everybody should be able to read scripture, they said only people who could read the scriptures in the original languages, in Hebrew and Greek, should be let loose on the Bible. Everybody else must go to the scriptures first through the catechism, which would give them a clear doctrinal way, a filter, they called it, of looking at the Bible so that it would condition the way that you saw the Bible. And that's one of the things that has happened to us in the West.
One of the things you point out is that Scripture began as an aristocratic art form, that it came from these unfair agrarian societies where aristocracy is exploiting the poor, but by exploiting the poor, it gave them the leisure time to create the arts and sciences. So from the bad came this good. So it begins as art, but not, as you say, a guideline for life or rules for behavior, but as just art, I guess.
Yes, and of course it was a performative art.
Right.
You didn't read your scriptures. And so a scripture was always chanted or sung or acted out in ritual. And that gave it a completely different dimension, so that reading scripture is a bit like reading the libretto of an opera or an aria.
Yeah.
You're missing half of it, and half of that experience is gone. So that art form was, it was combined with music, with acting, and with gesture, bodily gestures. Neurophysicists tell us that we learn a tremendous amount, that more than we realize, through our bodies, through our bodily actions. And, of course, when you chanted scripture, you bowed, you genuflected. All these things create an attitude in the mind. Just as when Muslims prostrate themselves in prayer with their heads touching the ground, their body is teaching them day by day, several times a day, at a body, a level deeper than the rational, what it is to leave behind the prancing, preening ego that is constantly calling attention to itself.
So are you saying that we should be, by just encountering Scripture as a written form, just reading it to ourselves, we're missing out on a much broader dimension that was intended by Scripture? You, as you say, people often regarded it as inert until it was ignited, you say, yes, by a living voice.
By a living voice and by ritual, and in community too.
Right.
Because the whole communal thing is important. It's supposed to weld you together. And reciting Scripture can be hard work. Monks of Europe would get up at midnight to chant the Psalms. They'd go to sleep again for a couple of hours and chant it again at dawn and throughout the day. And the discipline of the art form, the difficulty of the chant, the Latin, it's very exacting, and it took you out of yourself. The whole point of Scripture and all religion says that the thing that cripples us from religious insight is that we're immersed in ego, and that we therefore must transcend that ego. And now that's very difficult to do. I mean, as a child, as a nun, we were continually focused on our faults, our problems, how good our prayer had been, how we'd broken the rule. Was I going to get into heaven? It was all about me, and it was in a sense embedding us in the ego that we should be trying to transcend if we want to get beyond ourselves and be transformed and achieve our full potential. And you did that with the chant, because the exacting nature of the chant meant that you didn't have time to think about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You were just, you needed all your wits about you, A, to keep awake, if you're a Gregorian monk, but also to keep in tune with the Latin, and similarly the Quran, for example. The recitation of the Quran is a very, very exacting art form, and people will travel miles to hear a superb Quran reciter, because just as we would travel miles to hear a famous soprano, because the experience of listening to that Quranic recitation produces a strange emotion that they call huzn, a sense of sadness, sorrow, and yet beauty at the same time.
So of all the various scriptures and the various monotheistic traditions that you explore in the book, you say this is the one thing they all agree on, the importance of divesting yourself of the ego, of egotism.
Yes.
So I wonder, in this sense, the importance of not just confining, you know, the spiritual quest to yourself, but loving others. This must make this conversation quite current for you. You mentioned how this is really needed in our divided world. And I'm wondering, say something about that. Is that what inspired you to write the book, do you think?
No, well, you always start off with one view of the book.
Yeah.
And then you find a whole lot of other things that you'd never suspected. And I started with this idea of looking at Scripture as a performative art. But the deeper I go, they all insisted that Scripture must say something.
Say something of the moment, right? The current moment. That's really important, it seems.
The current moment, as this medieval mystics, Ibn Arabi, a great Muslim mystic, said, every time you recite the Quran, and notice it says recite, not read, every time you recite the Quran, it should mean something different to you. And if it doesn't, you're missing what God is intending for you at this particular moment. You must bring your own preoccupations to the Quran, and then it should impel you to go and act. And the bedrock message of the Quran is not jihad, as people say today, or holy war, or even belief. It is it's calling for the creation of a just and decent society where vulnerable, poor people are treated with respect and fairness. And similarly, the prophets of Israel had no time for people who attended the temple rituals or recited the Psalms piously. They insisted that that this was worthless unless you were prepared to look after the poor and the oppressed and take rulers to task for their war crimes. And Jesus said that those who would enter the kingdom were not those who'd said their prayers nicely in the temple or attended the temple rituals or said their prayers, but I was hungry, you gave me to eat. Thirsty, you gave me to drink. Sick, naked, and in prison, and you visited me. And so often we maintain that, you know, scriptures about being good and assuring my own salvation. Right now here in London, record numbers of people in this very rich city are sleeping rough on the streets. And 25% of the population of London are said to be living in poverty. But do we hear religious people speaking out, crying out like prophets against this? No, because we're hugging our religion to ourselves and not seeing that that it must impel us. Even the Buddha, you know, we often see the Buddha depicted lost in contemplation and yoga. And of course, he did a great deal of this. But there's a very revealing story in the Buddhist scripture that says that shortly after he'd achieved enlightenment, the inconvenient thought occurred to him that perhaps he should teach other people how to do the same. And he thought to himself, no, I don't want to do that. My method is very, very difficult and hard. People aren't going to want to do it. It's just going to be too discouraging. So I'll just leave that to one side. And at that point, the scripture says, the god Brahma, in the highest heaven, gave a terrible cry, and he says that then the world will be lost. The world will be utterly lost. And he descends from heaven, and he, Brahma, the enlightened, the god, kneels before the enlightened man, and he says, Lord, please preach your teaching. Look at the world in pain and suffering. And the scripture says that the Buddha looked at the world with the eye of a Buddha, and he spent the next 40 years of his life, which we don't often hear about, tramping through the towns and cities of India, helping people to deal with their suffering and their pain. And he insisted that his monks do the same. After achieving enlightenment, he said, go forth, monks, and travel throughout the world to heal the suffering of the world. Scripture should impel us to practical action. And our world is so hideously divided at the moment between rich and poor, that this is what we should be thinking about and talking about, not squabbling about dogmas or focusing entirely on our own salvation.
Karen Armstrong. Her book is The Lost Art of Scripture, Rescuing the Sacred Texts. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Thanks to a story he heard on KUER, Vic Velevis decided to tackle a major shortage in Utah.
I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there just like me where I had no idea about diaper banks and diaper drives and the fact that no safety net program covers diapers.
When you donate to KUER, you can support the distribution of diapers across the state thanks to the Utah Diaper Bank. Just choose our social good partner as your thank you gift when you give at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For hundreds of years now, religious people have gone looking through Scripture for answers or direction to support their beliefs and behavior. But the religion scholar Karen Armstrong says that's not what Scripture was intended for. So she's written a book to clear this all up. It's called The Lost Art of Scripture, Rescuing the Sacred Texts. It's interesting. One of the points you make in the book also is Scripture does not expect us to go back to the original meaning of the text. And as you've said before, it's an innovative art. Scripture is an innovative art. And there's this great story you tell about the prophet Abraham coming down from heaven after he's died to Rabbi Akiva's class. I think it's a story from Moses' class.
Yes.
Will you tell that story, please? It's a great story.
Yes. Well, Rabbi Akiva, after the loss of the temple, the Jews, the rabbis, were devastated by the loss of their temple. They couldn't read the ancient scriptures in the same way because the temple had been actually at the root of their spirituality and their heart. So Rabbi Akiva developed an inventive form of reading these texts, whereby you'd bring various texts together from all different parts of scripture that had nothing to do with one another in the original text, but apply it to a particular situation here and now. The fame of his brilliance reached heaven, and Moses got to hear about it. And he was intrigued, so he wanted to find out what was going on. So he came down, we're told, from heaven to earth and joined Rabbi Akiva's scripture class, sitting in the back row among the other students, but found to his astonishment and bewilderment that he couldn't understand a word of the Torah, the law, that had been revealed to him, to Moses, on Mount Sinai. It was utterly unrecognizable. But instead of being cross about this, he went back to heaven shaking his head proudly, rather like a proud father, saying, "My sons have defeated me. They've conquered me. They've gone beyond me." And one rabbi put it this way more succinctly. He said, "That which was not revealed to Moses was revealed to Rabbi Akiva and his generation in the second century." But it didn't stop there, because they said, the rabbis said that revelation did not happen once in the distant time past. It is ongoing. And every time a Jew confronts the sacred text and studies it with his rabbi, it should mean, it should have a fresh meaning to him. Because they imagine themselves standing on Mount Sinai beside Moses, listening to the Torah and finding something new in it. And in the early versions of the printed Talmud, there would be a blank page on which the student was expected to write his own insight and his own discovery. And if he didn't do that, they said, revelation would be incomplete. Because every time the Jew confronts the sacred text, it should speak to his circumstances here and now.
So you often hear people talking about scripture, the Bible in particular in this country, like the Constitution, that it had an original meaning that it's supposed to be interpreted and acted on. But you're saying that's not at all what scripture is.
Not in any sense, right through the Middle Ages. The monks that I was talking about earlier, had a fourfold message, which they'd learned from the Greek Christians, about how every sentence of scripture should be interpreted, first in its plain sense, next allegorically. Third, it should have a moral implications for your action and you know, so that you act in the world. And then a spiritual look at the end of time and how this works out in heaven. And every verse of the Bible was subjected to that fourfold ascent from the literal meaning of text to the spiritual. This was absolutely common in all scriptures. The great Chinese Neo-Confucian in the Middle Ages told his students, you must not read current beliefs into the scriptures. They must mean something new to you. But we've got into the habit of doing this in the modern period, because modern scholarship does that, doesn't it? People studying the classics or the Greek or Roman classics go back to the ancient text to find what the original was about. So we go back to the past. And Luther and Calvin and the Protestants wanted to go back to the early church. The trouble is that they were men and women of the early modern period. They could not go back to the first century, where most Christians were actually Jews who had a very, very different take on scripture. This was absolutely continuous. You had to make scripture speak to the present. And now you have in the United States, there are Christian fundamentalists who want to go back to the early Hebrew legislation that you find in some books of the Bible, which would include, for example, the stoning of disobedient children. Whereas the rabbis would have had none of this. We've surpassed that. We've gone beyond it. And so this backward-looking scripture, this preoccupation with the original text, it may be very interesting in a scholarly way, but it is not propelling us towards the action that it should. It is not saying how should we view our troubled world in the present and make it a better place.
I like how you mentioned this literalistic mindset. One of the ways you've said is that if you're reading a book of, you know, if you're reading Pride and Prejudice, you're not astonished or dismayed to hear that Darcy or Mr. Bingley, that they didn't actually exist.
Yes.
And you also mentioned in the book, there's a character in the novel I think it's Robert Elsmere by Mrs. Humphrey Ward, who said this. I want to quote it because you mentioned it in the book. This character said, "If the Gospels are not true in fact, as history, I cannot see how they are true at all or of any value."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mention that because that is the teaching of the predominant religion in Utah, for example, the Mormons. They see their own scripture, the Book of Mormon, as being true in fact and true in history, and they believe the same of the Bible, and they connect it to their own origin story, those kinds of things. What do you make of that?
Well, of course, the Mormons were founded in the 19th century when this idea had got taken root in Christianity as a whole, modern Christianity, that you go back, that the scriptures are true and fact in every detail, as that character says, in true as to fact. Whereas it was impossible to write scripture before as we write it today, before the 18th century. In the 18th century, we discovered archaeology, scientific archaeology. We looked at we learned about ancient languages, etc. And there was a new vogue for historical writing up until then. Up until then, nobody thought that the past could be recreated in such detail. Even the great Greek historians, Herodotus, for example, he includes his masses of mythical material that couldn't possibly have happened in fact. And perhaps older listeners will agree with me that it's probably more normal for human beings to forget rather than remember. We don't hold things in our memories very well. And scripture tells us what we should remember, but it does so not by reciting the facts of history as they happened, but telling these stories in such a way that they will mean something, something special to you. Why? What did it mean, for example, when Jacob wrestled with a mysterious stranger and found that he was somehow wrestling symbolically with his twin brother Esau, with whom he had a difficult relationship, with himself and with his God? A profound story. But did it happen? Who knows? But that would not have interested people. And the four Gospels, each of the four Gospels gives us a wholly different picture of Jesus.
Right.
The people who put those Gospels together chose them deliberately because they felt that each of those insights was important. They could easily have amalgamated them or created a text that was that agreed historically. But Matthew has a very different take on Jesus from Mark and Mark from Luke. And all those insights are valid. However contradictory they are valid. And John, of course, is different again.
Right.
Paul has a completely different view of Christ. Paul. Paul only wrote seven of the letters that are attributed to him. The rest were written in his name by people who wanted to bring Paul up to date in the second century. And when Paul had believed that the Messiah, Jesus, would return at any moment in his own lifetime, so this was the end time, and everyone was to live as though there were no divisions between people. There would be neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. These second century people said, look, we've got to live in the Roman Empire. We've got to obey those norms. So they come in with all this talk about wives, be obedient to your husbands, slaves to your masters, etc. These are the Greco-Roman household codes that would have been good behaviour in Roman society. So scripture is sometimes brought up to date in a rather unpleasant way.
So how do you explain the God of the Old Testament ordering mass murder or destroying the world in a peak, as you said, of anger in the story of the flood? How do you make sense of that? If you are a skeptic, if you're an atheist, you see that just as a contradiction, as hypocrisy, as...
It's a very good question. Yeah. And I think all the scriptures have violence in them. All the scriptures have violence in them. New Testament, too, has Jesus in the book of Revelation coming from battle like a Roman emperor at a triumph, his blood drenched in the blood of his victims. This is the Jesus who Mark predicts as a crucified victim. So how do we reconcile that? Because they're not telling us facts. We regard history, as I've said now before, as factual, and in our factual scientific world, if something didn't happen, it isn't true. What these Gospels and what the scriptures are saying, look at what is there. Look at what is true, but not in any literal way. Four different versions of Jesus, each telling us something about the Messiah, but with a very different message. But also these violent passages that we've all got. We have to remember that the scriptures, for all their, we call them divinely inspired, they're human texts. And we are a violent species. We are the only species, I believe, that kills its own kind. And we've created, with our big brains, we've created hideous ways and efficient ways of killing more people than ever before in any other species. And we've got, and the scriptures reflect that. If they just presented us with sort of loving, sweet images, this would be entire. We'd leave half the picture out. In the convent, we often think about the Psalms, which we chanted every day in Latin, as beautiful and loving. The Lord is my shepherd. It's lovely. These beautiful texts, but some of the Psalms are extremely violent. And there came a terrible time when we had to, the Vatican Council told us we had to put these psalms into English, chant them in English. And if you can imagine a church full of about 80 or 90 very restrained British nuns warbling politely, "Oh God, smash their teeth in their mouths." we all just fell about laughing. I mean, it seems so. But what we should be thinking, I've been thinking about it a lot now, what we should be saying is we are humanity standing before the divine. And this is in us too. This violence is in us too. And we take ownership of that violence, realizing it's in us, in our fellow Christians, in our fellow human beings, as well as in our enemies. And I think that is what the scriptures are reminding us. They remind us of our extreme fallibility, that we're not saints, we're not always full of compassion. We're a mixture, and we have to accept that and take it into our being.
What do you make of the idea expressed a good bit these days that someone who says, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious? Because you say toward the end of the book that people used to aspire to deification, but now, this is how you put it, we simply diet or have a makeover.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, people wanted transformation when they went to scripture, but transformation means leaving the ego behind. Mm-hmm. And very often scriptures are used to enhance our ego, to make us feel good and special and loved by God, and we are the chosen people, and we don't talk to people of other religions or even other Christians who have different views, etc. And this is all about me. And that has to go, because the script to be transformed, that means that as all the scriptures say, working your it is not complete unless you have gone out to the world in practical action to heal that suffering, to heal that political problem. But we're just polishing our souls. And also, you know, all that early childhood or an early youth business in the convent, when we simply were obsessed with our own performance, our own sanctity, our own religious vocation, and applying all the psalms to me personally, this has left me, it's rather like a bad sexual experience, very hard to get beyond it, in a sense. Because this was a complete perversion of what religion should be. Ecstasy. People often say they feel ecstatic when they're in church, or they feel wonderful feelings of joy and wonder in ecstasy. But ecstasy comes from the Latin, from the Greek. Ecstasis means to stand outside the self, to leave the self behind. And you have ecstasis, really, when you leave the self behind, as the Buddha did, and go out. Not nourish your own holiness and spirituality and enlightenment, but travel through the world to heal the pain of the world.
So coming back to your writing about the right and left sides of the brain, you say the right hemisphere has been marginalized. And so I guess the discipline of compassion and altruism has also been stripped away in that sense.
Indeed, indeed. That plus our literal reading of scripture and our sense that I am the center of our world. You said earlier about how we regard transformation as, you know, we want to get a makeover or lose weight or something, or to be a nicer person. Religion is not about being nice. Jesus was not a nice person. Would have been quite a disturbing person. The prophets were not nice people. They were difficult people sometimes because they were saying unpalatable truths. Ecstasy does not, and religion is not achieving a nice warm glow and feeling that you're in a community of believers and the rest of the world doesn't understand and you will then go to heaven and with all these like-minded souls. This has become a sort of very much a me version of religion. It's part of the egotism of our culture, the way we sort of have to feel we have to tell the whole world in tweets what we've been doing today and spreading our latest messages and discoveries around the world. We talk about self-fulfillment in our work, for example, not how can our work actually help to improve a world that is going to pieces in a handbasket. And another thing that scripture tells us to do in India and China, as well as going out to compassion, is concern for the environment. This was crucial in both India and China. And today there are Chinese philosophers who call themselves the New Confucians, who say that what we can bring from our scriptures to the world is this concern for nature and the natural world. And what our scriptures talk about is preserving that nature, which things are getting worse and worse by the day, as we know with the recent discussions in Madrid. And yet there are people denying it and seeing it as not relevant, whereas it's a scriptural injunction. And the ancient Aryans were very concerned about the fragility of the cosmos and felt that it had to be somehow strengthened. They had to strengthen the gods that were keeping the cosmos going. And they did so in various rituals that enacted what they regarded as the creation of the world, of which there were many, many versions, not just one, in the Hindu scriptures. And of course, these rituals did nothing scientifically to help the environment, but what they did was create an attitude of concern and appreciation of the fragility that was deep in Hindu spirituality. So that, too, is an important imperative for our time, which we neglect at our peril.
Karen Armstrong. Her new book is The Lost Art of Scripture, Rescuing the Sacred Texts. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd like to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Viarta and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.